This was had to be the best 2 weeks. Has anybody ever had a better 2 weeks than this?
Well, President Trump got what he wanted, his massive tax and spending bill on his desk for signature by Independence Day. For Friday, the 4th of July, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang. In a lawsuit against the Trump administration, the ACLU alleges that federal agents are picking people for deportation solely because they look Latino.
It sucks. There was antagonized for being Hispanic, you know?
Also, Iranian activist Narges Mohammadi says the war between Israel and Iran has damaged the fight for democracy in her country. We speak with a journalist who interviewed the Nobel laureate.
In the sense that it destroyed pillars of society that any potential future democracy would build on.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston.
Ladies and gentlemen, President of the United States and First Lady Melania Trump.
Military jets soared over the White House tonight as the nation pauses to mark Independence Day. A crowd of supporters, lawmakers, and invited guests gathered on the South Lawn, waving American flags as President Trump addressed them from a balcony.
You have the hottest country anywhere in the world, so that's the way it is, and that's the way we like it. And it's only going to get hotter, I promise you that. After that spectacular display of American power, let me just say that God bless the United States military and God bless the USA.
Trump is using the July 4th holiday to sign a massive tax cut and spending bill into law. The legislation pumps billions of dollars into national defense and enforcement at the southern border. It also slashes Medicaid and food assistance programs. Critics of the legislation say it will increase the national debt. Supporters say the bill will strengthen the country's economy. At least 13 people are dead and about 20 children are missing from a day camp after severe flooding swept across central Texas. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports emergency crews are scouring the Guadalupe River, where torrential rain triggered flash floods and dozens of water rescues.
A stalled weather system dumped over 10 inches of rain on parts of central Texas. This region is known as Flash Flood Alley, and there are reports of a wall of water hitting residential areas in Kerrville, not far from San Antonio, as well as campgrounds and RV parks that were full for the holiday. The city of Kerrville has activated its emergency management plan. Officials advise those near creeks, streams, and the Guadalupe River to immediately move to higher ground. For NPR News, I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deporting 8 immigrants to South Sudan. Gustavo Sagrero of member station KUOW reports a prisoner's rights group has filed for an emergency restraining order.
The Seattle Clemency Project argues the federal government is intentionally trying to punish these men by sending them to South Sudan. It says punishing people in this way for immigration violations is unconstitutional and violates an 1896 Supreme Court ruling on the Chinese Exclusion Act. That ruling says immigrants can't be given a punishment without first being charged and tried in a court of law. The 8 men had either finished or were close to finishing sentences for various violent crimes. For the past 6 weeks, they've been held in a shipping container on a U.S. base in the African country of Djibouti. For NPR News, I'm Gustavo Sagrero in Seattle.
This is NPR News in Washington. A massive wildfire in central California continues to burn out of control. The Madre Fire has scorched 70,000 acres and has forced evacuations for some residents east of Santa Maria. Fire crews have contained 10% of the blaze. In rural western Colorado, people are vying to see who can catch the biggest number of invasive fish to win prize money and save native species. Colorado Public Radio's Tina Sieg reports the smallmouth bass harvesting competition runs through August 10th.
The Ridgeway Reservoir Smallmouth Bass Classic is both a mouthful and a highly effective way to remove harmful fish. Eric Garduño with Colorado Parks and Wildlife says smallmouth bass can decimate endangered species.
And they can eat a fish that's up to at least a third of their body length. And yeah, they just open that mouth up, suck the fish in, and swallow it whole.
A single angler can catch thousands of smallmouth bass over the course of the competition. The one with the most wins $10,000. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
AAA is predicting a record number of travelers on the nation's roads and at airports over the long July 4th holiday weekend. Gasoline prices are cheaper. Regular gas is averaging $3.15 a gallon nationwide, 36 cents less than last year at this time. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. Consider becoming a business or community sponsor to help KAXE build strong connections now and into the future. Text the word SPONSOR to 218-326-1234. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. Well, President Trump, by his own telling, is on a roll.
This was had to be the best 2 weeks. Has anybody ever had a better 2 weeks than that?
Today, he put his signature on a mega bill that contains many of his campaign promises, including tax cuts and increased funding for border enforcement. It caps off a pivotal stretch in his presidency that also includes the strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has been following all of this and joins us now. Hi, Tam.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, let's start with the one big, beautiful bill. The president got the win he was looking for. Now what?
Now he needs to sell it to the American people, and that may end up being more difficult than getting Congress to pass it as quickly as they did. You know, President Trump has benefited from having an extremely compliant Republican majority, but Democrats have been quite united in branding this as a tax cut that will overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and big businesses, paid for by making life harder for the working class. They point to an independent analysis that found this bill could add trillions to the deficit and kick millions of people off their health coverage. White House officials point out that individual pieces of the bill are popular, even if public polling finds the broader package isn't. So with the midterms coming up next year, the president and his party are working to convince voters that this bill will make their lives better.
Okay, well, obviously a president's work is never done. So what is next on Trump's docket?
Yeah, this has been a really busy period for him, in part of his own making. He set up a traffic jam of deadlines, and the next one comes early next week. You might remember back in April when he imposed what he called reciprocal tariffs on more than 100 countries.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. And then,
that.
Yeah, the markets freaked out, and he temporarily backed down.
Temporarily.
Well, that pause is supposed to come to an end early next week, and despite a lot of talk about President Trump being the ultimate dealmaker, there are only one and a half deals done at this point, a signed trade agreement with the UK and a framework agreement with Vietnam. Reporters have been asking the president what comes next and whether the tariffs will snap back. And last night on Air Force One, he said he was going to start sending countries letters telling them what tariffs the U.S. would impose on their exports.
We'll probably have 10 or 12 go out tomorrow. And over the next few days, I think by the 9th, they'll be fully covered. And they'll range in value from maybe 60 or 70% tariffs to 10 and 20% tariffs.
When it comes to tariffs, Trump has really been all over the map and has changed deadlines and tariff rates repeatedly. So I caution this could all change again.
Right. It absolutely could. Why do you think President Trump seems so casual about tariffs?
He is a practitioner of strategic ambiguity, but he also just seems to love tariffs as a tool. He boasts about how much money they'll bring into the U.S. Treasury, and he isn't buying the argument from economists all the way up to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who say that tariffs are inflationary and will lead to American consumers paying more for the things they need. The view in Trump world is that the experts are wrong and Trump is right, and he even joked about it last night.
And I have another hat back there. It says,
Donald Trump was right about everything. And I said, no. I said, no, no, that sounds a little too conceited, but it happens to be true, I must tell you.
It's become something of a mantra. Trump and his allies point to the solid jobs report the last 3 months when many economists were predicting a slowdown, and the so far tame inflation data, the Iran strikes that led to a ceasefire rather than a wider war, and the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill getting to his desk for a signature today when everyone doubted it was possible on that timeline.
That is NPR's Tamara Key. Thank you so much, Tam, and happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th to you and everyone listening as well.
The ACLU sued the Trump administration this week, alleging that federal immigration agents roving the streets of Southern California are picking people up for deportation based on the color of their skin. Fears that the government is racially profiling are growing as agents continue to target street vendors, day laborers, car wash workers, even people just out for walks. NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
Immigration agents arrested Emma De Paz on June 19th when they showed up at a Los Angeles Home Depot and began chasing day laborers through the parking lot. She had been selling breakfast to those workers from a food cart on the sidewalk. She later called her brother, Carlos Barrera, from the Federal Detention Center. Here's what he says she told him.
La hincaron, le apuntaron con armas largas como que fuera una criminal.
They handcuffed her, forced her onto her knees, and pointed a gun at her, Barrera says. His sister is undocumented, but he says the agents could not have known that. They didn't ask if she had papers. They didn't ask her any questions.
No le preguntaron si tenía documentos o no, simplemente la agarraron y la metieron a las vans que cargaban.
They simply grabbed her and loaded her into the van, Barrera says. He and his sister are from Guatemala. They're dark-skinned.
Asumieron que era hispana y por ser hispana se la llevaron.
They assumed she was Hispanic, and that's why they took her, he says. His sister is still detained. Since early June, ICE and Border Patrol agents have been carrying out surprise raids all across Southern California, often in public places. In a federal lawsuit this week, the ACLU and other legal groups said agents patrolling the streets are engaged in widespread racial profiling. ACLU lawyer Mohammed Tajzar spoke at a press conference announcing the suit.
To them, if you are brown, they will hunt you down. To them, if you have dark skin, they will take you in.
Many recent immigration sweeps have been filmed by bystanders. The videos show masked agents descending on individuals or groups of people out in public. They appear overwhelmingly to be working-class Latinos.
There is a real sense that it is open season on anyone who appears to be an immigrant.
Eva Bitran is director of immigrants' rights at the ACLU of Southern California.
They are arriving, corralling people before asking one single question, just based on their location and their appearance. Often they are handcuffing and putting in vans people even before they have asked for their papers, or even after a person has said, I am a U.S. citizen, or I have a green card, I have every right to be here.
She hopes the judge hearing the ACLU's suit will find agents are acting unlawfully and order them to stop. Jean Reese is professor of immigration law at the University of Southern California.
I suspect that there is a lot of illegality going on.
Under federal law, immigration agents can arrest someone in public without a warrant, but they have to first have reasonable suspicion that they're in the country illegally. But Reese says,
reasonable suspicion has to be based on what's called articulable facts. So it can't just be based on race. It can't be this person looked like what I think someone from another country looks like.
In a statement to NPR, Tricia McLaughlin with the Department of Homeland Security denied that agents are targeting people based on the color of their skin. DHS enforcement operations are highly targeted and officers do their due diligence, she said, adding, we know who we are targeting ahead of time. Lawyers and advocates say those claims are undermined by the videos of people being picked off the streets seemingly at random.
He's an American citizen, bro, come on!
And by the fact that even U.S. citizens are being detained, people like Javier Ramirez. On June 12th, Border Patrol agents walked into a junkyard east of Los Angeles and handcuffed Ramirez and other men working there. His brother, Abimael Dominguez, filmed his arrest on his cell phone.
Yeah, he's a U.S. citizen, bro. All U.S. citizens. All U.S. citizens. Look what you guys are doing.
Ramirez tussles with an agent who has him pinned against a fence. The agent pushes him to the ground. Agents then load him into a van. Dominguez, still filming, runs after it.
They're hostaging my brother! Hey, you can't take him!
I recently met Dominguez outside the junkyard.
We're Americans. You're not targeting undocumented people, brother.
Are you just racial profiling? Because if you're telling, if somebody's telling you, I'm an American, I got my passport in my wallet, you release the guy, let him go.
According to court papers, agents took Ramirez to a downtown L.A. detention center. They verified that he was a U.S. citizen. They also charged him with assaulting, resisting, or impeding a federal officer. He was released on bail, but his brother says he's traumatized and doesn't want to leave his house.
You know, that sucks. That sucks to be a U.S. citizen and not be able to walk in the country of freedom, you know? It sucks that we're antagonized for being Hispanic, you know?
An L.A. federal judge has scheduled the first hearing to consider the ACLU's racial profiling claims against the government next week. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Los Angeles.
High temperatures have swept through much of the U.S. this summer already. And when it's this hot, some turn to super cooling their homes. NPR's Ayana Archie explains.
Supercooling calls for significantly lowering your home's temperature during off-peak hours and letting the cool air get you through peak hours. That's when the sun is highest and energy is more expensive to produce. But does it work? Yes, no, or maybe, depending on who you ask. Daniel Barber is a professor of architecture at the Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands. He has been researching ways to make people less reliant on air conditioning systems. He says supercooling could be a good place to start, with some caveats.
Running an air conditioner at 60 degrees is going to be pretty energy intensive and also produce a lot of HFCs. So there's serious costs associated.
HFCs refer to hydrofluorocarbons, a type of greenhouse gas. But Barber said supercooling could be effective if you take good care of your air conditioning system and keep the windows and curtains closed. Opinions are split among power companies. Energy company Arizona Public Service generally agrees. It suggests customers who want to lower their bills, drop their thermostat's temperature in the morning, raise it during peak hours from 4 to 7 p.m., and after that, set it how you like. Georgia Power encourages its customers to use less energy from 2 to 7 p.m., but it said a home would need to be extremely efficient for supercooling to work. It also noted there isn't a concrete range of temperatures that would make the method most effective. It would depend on things such as the home size, the outside temperature, and residents' comfort level. If nothing else, don't keep switching the AC on and off if you're trying to be energy efficient.
It's a lot of energy to get it started, to cool the room once it's already hot. You know, the thing to keep in mind is that air conditioning doesn't make the room cool. It just moves that hot air out.
Though there's not quite a consensus on supercooling, experts do agree on other energy-saving methods, like changing air filters regularly and sealing windows and doors to prevent drafts. Ayana Archie, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We received support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger variety pack featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Minnesota DNR reminds boaters to stay safe while enjoying the water this season. Wear your life jacket and make sure children are wearing theirs. Stay sober, let others know where you are going, and be aware of the weather. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us. The 14th annual Ironman Car Show is Saturday, July 5th from 10 to 2 at the Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. Classic cars and trucks will be along pathways with live music and concessions. Regular museum rates apply. And Brainerd Community Action and Brainerd Parks and Recreation presents a movie in the park Saturday, July 5th at 9 p.m. See Goonies at Lyman P. White Park. Bring your own blanket or chair. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to their Oodles of Noodles and Yankee Doodles fundraiser Monday, July 7th at 6 p.m. Enjoy a spaghetti dinner, followed by a patriotic concert by the First City Singers. The Brainerd Public Library now offers Memory Maker Kits for checkout. These kits are specially designed for caregivers of those experiencing memory challenges. The materials are meant to spark conversation and provide positive interactions. And don't forget, we have our question of the week. Have you ever been in a parade? Tell us about any memorable experiences. You can text us at 218-333-7425. 326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. When the Trump administration moved to cancel about $500 million in grants from the Department of Justice, they said the programs did not align with the administration's priorities. Organizations across the country say those dollars helped support crime survivors, reduce street violence, assist police and prosecutors, and protect children. Marisa Lagos from member station KQED in San Francisco tells us about one of those programs.
Federal funding helped the Asian Women's Shelter in San Francisco create a program to serve Arab and Muslim victims of domestic violence and human trafficking. Like this woman, who came to the United States in 2017 after marrying her husband in their home country in the Middle East.
I left everything, my family. I was working in my country. I had a life in my country. So I left everything for him and for the family.
She had one baby, then became pregnant with their second in the U.S. But after arriving in California, she says he began to physically abuse her.
He is not the guy I married in my country.
She asks that NPR not use her name or home country because she is a survivor of abuse and still worries for her safety. She says she tried to get help at her mosque and from the police. Nothing changed. So in 2019, she called the Asian Women's Shelter. But it would take 2 years for her to get the courage to leave. When she finally did,
they helped me to get an apartment. They helped me with to find schools for the kids. Lately, I got my driver license.
If not for the shelter, she says,
either I'm in a hospital or I'm dead.
The program is one of 373 across the nation that received a letter in April informing them they were losing a federal grant from the Department of Justice. The letter stated that the program no longer lines up with agency priorities, including supporting law enforcement operations, protecting American children, and supporting American victims of trafficking and sexual assault. Here's President Trump in a March speech at the Department of Justice.
We want to protect Americans, and we protect everybody that's in our country, American or not American. We want to have a safe and proud country.
In a written statement to NPR, the Justice Department reiterated its commitment to agency priorities, but didn't answer questions about why organizations like the Asian Women's Shelter were cut. But California Attorney General Rob Bonta insists it's clear the programs are losing funds because of who they serve, communities of color and immigrants.
I think they're unapologetically transparent about that. This is just political targeting, and they don't actually look at the substance of what the program does. They just look at the name, and they make a decision based on that.
In all, the canceled grants nationally add up to about $500 million, according to an analysis by the Council on Criminal Justice. That money benefited a wide range of programs. In addition to serving crime survivors, other grantees focused on reducing street violence, assisting police and prosecutors, and protecting children. The cuts make up a small but significant slice of the more than 14,000 grants DOJ has awarded nationally since 2021, totaling more than $15 billion. The states receiving the most money during that period were California and Texas. Even those who have called for more oversight of these grant funds say they're troubled by the cuts. Retired Los Angeles Police Department Deputy Chief Phil Tingrides agrees there should be more accountability to ensure that these public funds are being used properly.
I think it's something that has to be highly regulated, highly monitored to make sure that the money is going to a useful purpose, to the right purpose.
But he says that thoughtful review process does not appear to be happening, at least not yet. Several organizations have filed a class action lawsuit alleging that the grant changes are unconstitutional. Other groups like the Asian Women's Shelter are also appealing the cuts through a process set out by DOJ. The woman who found help at the Asian Women's Shelter says she's trying to look ahead and has dreams for her children.
I want them to be free. I want to be free too. I want them to visit the world. I want to take them everywhere.
Her divorce proceedings are ongoing, and anytime she needs support, someone from the Asian Women's Shelter is there beside her in court. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
Today, Americans will celebrate the nation's birthday with cookouts, parades, and, of course, fireworks. The last time President Trump was in office, fireworks got a pass from the U.S.-China trade war, but not this year. And that means firecrackers and Roman candles could be more costly and harder to come by this 4th of July. NPR's Scott Horsley explains.
For many Americans, the highlight of any 4th of July is a noisy aerial display of exploding rockets. But for the fireworks we use to mark Independence Day, the U.S. is almost entirely dependent on China. Julie Heckman, who heads the American Pyrotechnics Association, notes that China has been producing fireworks for over 1,000 years, and the country is the world's leading supplier.
For the U.S. market, 99% of the backyard consumer fireworks are manufactured in China, and 90% of the professional display fireworks. So they are basically our sole source.
And like almost everything the U.S. buys from China, fireworks were hit this year with double, even triple-digit import taxes. Heckman says the resulting price hikes will likely take some of the sparkle out of this year's 4th of July.
I would anticipate that most people are going to get a little less bang for their buck this year.
Heckman says the tariffs took effect at the worst possible time, just as firework shipments from China would typically be at their peak. Some importers simply halted deliveries to avoid paying tariffs as high as 145%.
These are all small family businesses. They need to evaluate how much can a company absorb and how much do they actually need to pass on to the consumer.
John Sorgai's family has been in the fireworks business for generations. His great-grandfather set up shop in Hudson, Ohio back in 1902. In addition to selling fireworks, Sorgai's company stages hundreds of professional shows each year. As soon as this 4th of July is over, he'll start looking ahead to 2026.
This is go time for us. It's go time for the 4th of July, but it's also go time to get your orders in and get them moving for next year.
Next year was expected to be an explosive one for the fireworks industry. Not only does the 4th fall on a Saturday in 2026, which typically means more backyard fireworks sales, but it's the climax of a year-long celebration of the nation's 250th birthday. It's hard to plan for that big party, though, without knowing what the tariffs will be. For now, Chinese fireworks are being taxed at 30%, but who knows if that will rebound to April's level of 145%. Sorgai says that would choke off a lot of imports and turn many of next year's 4th of July displays into duds.
I mean, your $50,000 show is going to look like a $30,000 show. Your $30,000 show is going to look like a $15,000 to $18,000 show. And then when you get down to the smaller shows, which are a lot of the shows, those shows will probably just have to say, we're not doing it.
Julie Heckman of the Pyrotechnics Association says given the strict safety and environmental rules in this country, it's doubtful the U.S. is going to start making its own fireworks. Members of her trade group are hoping that Trump's taste for showmanship will lead him to grant their industry a tariff reprieve.
We know he loves fireworks, and he's been talking about America's salute to the 250th from day one, and our industry wants to be a major player in that.
Trump has lit the fuse on this trade war. It remains to be seen whether it brings a bust or a boom. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Find out how you can celebrate America's independence throughout northern Minnesota with KAXE's Guide to Fireworks and Parades at KAXE.org. And if we're missing your local event, email us at news@KAXE.org. Now we'll take you to the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Danny Frayer with the Up North Report. The 2025 Kids Count Data Book by the Annie E. Casey Foundation has released its findings for Minnesota. The report examines results for children in four categories: education, health, economic well-being, and family and community. 69% of Minnesota fourth graders are not proficient at reading, and 66% of eighth graders lack acceptable math skills. Alicia Porter is the Minnesota State Director for the Children's Defense Fund. She says while the state has ranked fifth nationally for the past 3 years due to the state's good investments in child well-being, there is room for improvement.
I think in the area of child poverty rates, I'd like to just highlight in Minnesota, 10% of all children live in poverty, with Black and Hispanic children experiencing disproportionately higher rates compared to white children.
Porter notes another disparity, low birth weights. The report states that although 7% of all babies are born with low birth weight, Black babies faced significantly higher numbers compared to white babies. It also says children and teens' death rates and obesity numbers increased. Minnesota's high-profile community solar program will stick around after state lawmakers opted not to approve a sunset provision. Assistance groups say that's good news for renters and low-income households seeking lower energy bills. In the recent legislative session, a group of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle proposed phasing out the program, arguing it didn't make economic sense with more utility-scale solar projects coming on board. But organizers working with under-resourced populations strongly pushed to keep it in place. Keiko Miller, with Minneapolis Climate Action, says they don't have to worry about this option becoming out of reach again.
Community solar flips it all on its head and allows all people to participate evenly and benefit from renewable energy.
Minnesota's program started in 2013 and is viewed as a national model. Officials say it allows people who aren't in a position to install solar panels on their roof to subscribe to a community solar garden instead. Minnesota's transition to the warmer months has been rough with the air quality from wildfire smoke. With the tail end of Minnesota's spring fire season and occasional smoke from Canadian wildfires, animal experts say pets need protection too. The American Humane Society says, just like their owners, the respiratory systems of dogs and cats can suffer in strong, smoky conditions. The organization's Dr. Thomas Edling says dogs need their outside time on a daily basis, but when the air quality is bad, it should be limited to mainly bathroom breaks. He talks about complications with dogs that can't resist running around.
Younger dogs especially are very prone to doing that. And when you do that, you just make the situation worse because you are bringing more air in quickly, more particulate matter, things like that.
He adds owners should avoid activities like playing fetch when outside with their dog. AHS says older pets and certain breeds, including French bulldogs and pugs, are more susceptible to poor air quality and require extra vigilance. After any outdoor activity, owners are encouraged to monitor their pet for coughing, sneezing, and difficulty breathing. If the animal shows signs it breathed in too much unhealthy air, owners should consult a veterinarian for possible treatment. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has installed signage recognizing Highway 169 as the Senator David J. Tomasoni Memorial Cross Range Expressway. The recognition spans between Itasca County Road 69 in Marble and St. Louis County Road 7 in Mountain Iron. The Minnesota State Legislature passed bills to designate the highway section in May of last year. Tomasoni, from Chris Holm, served in the legislature for 3 decades, starting in the House in 1993. He was elected to the Senate in 2000 and served until months before his death in August 2022, about 1 year after announcing he had been diagnosed with ALS. MnDOT calls the memorial a fitting tribute for the senator. The agency says that during his career, Tomasoni made safe roads and transportation a priority for his constituents. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org. I'm Dani Frere, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang. The situation for Iranian people is more dangerous now than before the war. That's a quote from Nobel laureate Narges Mohammadi, writing to Wall Street Journal reporter Suna Engel Rasmussen. The war that Mohammadi is referring to is the 12-day war between Israel and Iran. Narges Mohammadi said she was deeply concerned for activists in Iran and about government repression in the coming days. And Suna Engel Rasmussen joins us now to talk about his interview. Welcome.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. Can you just tell us more about Narges Mohammadi? She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2023, right? Can you tell us more about her activism?
Yeah, Narges Mohammadi has been one of the most prominent human rights defenders in Iran of the past three decades. She has been kind of a tireless defender, not just of women's rights, but of human rights and democracy in general. She has been arrested a number of times. She's been tried 9 times. She's received over 36 years in total in prison sentences and has served about 10 years so far. But she stayed in the country. And that has endeared her to a lot of Iranians as well, who can see the courage from this person sort of staying in the country, mm-hmm. even while the regime has threatened her for decades.
Yeah. Well, now she's expressing concern that repression in Iran will intensify even more in the coming days. Why does she feel that way?
She's worried that the Iranian state will do what it's done in the past, which is respond to both pressure from external enemies, but also pressure from within, with repression, basically, with throwing activists in jail and stifling any signs of dissent in the country. The reaction from the Iranian state following the war has been to arrest a lot of people on accusations of spying for Israel. 6 people at least have already been executed after swift trials. And the crimes that the state is accusing these people of having committed is either spying for Israel or smuggling drones into the country that were used during the first wave of attacks. But we've seen in the past that allegations of espionage on behalf of foreign powers has also been used against political dissidents inside Iran.
Well, I saw that your interview was conducted in writing because of poor internet connections. And during the war, there was this near total communication blackout that was imposed on people in Iran. What did Mohammadi have to say about that blackout?
Yeah, it actually took several days just to get this interview. There was a special period for 3 or 4 days where it was very difficult to get in touch with anyone inside the country. That meant that it was difficult for outsiders, for journalists like myself, to accurately report the toll of the war in Iran, both the civilian toll, but also the damage done to Iranian military and nuclear facilities. But then it also meant for Narges Mohammadi and her fellow activists, or just Iranians in general, that it was difficult for them to communicate internally. It was difficult to guess whether you should be evacuating from the area where you lived in. And it was also nearly impossible for activists to organize if they had wanted to mount any kind of opposition or any kind of activism against the state or even protests against the Israeli war. So I think it's important also to understand that a lot of Iranians, like Narges Mohammadi, even though she's spent decades fighting the Islamic Republic of Iran, she doesn't want a foreign power to topple the regime, because she thinks that any kind of regime change in Iran that is orchestrated by a foreign power would be illegitimate. And in that sense, she says that Iranians were sort of caught between both fighting their own government, but then also having a foreign power fighting a war against themselves.
Well, with respect to the fight for democratic change in Iran, how much does Mohammadi think that this war has impacted that progress?
So she says it's impacted Iran's fight for democracy in two ways. One impact that has had is the one we just discussed, where the Iranian state is likely to intensify its repression of dissent inside the country. But she also says that the war itself, like the Israeli war and at the end also the American war against Iran, damaged the struggle for democracy in the sense that it destroyed pillars of society that any potential future democracy would build on. So the Israeli attacks, yes, they targeted military installations and nuclear facilities, but they also hit residential areas in Tehran. They also hit areas of the capital and other big cities that are important for the civilian economy. And it weakened a population that would otherwise sort of be the driving force in any kind of push for democracy.
Suna Engel Rasmussen, Wall Street Journal reporter, telling us about his interview with Iranian Nobel laureate Narges Mohammadi. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
One of the impacts of the Republican megabill that just got signed into law is that millions of women will likely lose access to birth control and other kinds of reproductive health care. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
Nowhere in the GOP spending plan does it say the words Planned Parenthood, but it bans Medicaid payments to large healthcare nonprofits that offer abortions. Alexis McGill Johnson is the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
This is going to be devastating for the patients that Planned Parenthood serves.
The organization says 200 clinics across the country are now in jeopardy.
The majority of Planned Parenthood health centers that are at risk of closure are in medically underserved areas. They're in areas where there is primary care health shortage, right? They're in rural areas.
And most are in states where abortion is still legal. The defunding proposal will not affect states which have already stopped Planned Parenthood clinics from getting Medicaid funding.
This is really a backdoor abortion ban.
Michelle Velasquez is an attorney at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. There are 21 Planned Parenthood clinics in that state. She says abortion is just one thing that happens at these clinics. If they close, it will deprive women of other kinds of essential health care as well.
People just want to be able to go see the doctor, go see their nurse practitioner when they need to, and get birth control and get STI testing and treatment and have preventative exams for cervical cancer.
In addition to the Planned Parenthood provision, the huge cuts in Medicaid will also jeopardize access to women's health care. Dana Singheiser is with the organization Contraceptive Access Initiative.
By taking a sledgehammer to Medicaid, we estimate that 2.7 million women of reproductive age will lose access to contraceptive care, and another 1.4 to 2 million women of reproductive age would lose access to contraceptive care due to the attacks on the Affordable Care Act.
Singheiser described the impact as breathtaking. NPR reached out to the White House for comment, but did not hear back. Katia Riddle, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. When people talk about family farms being endangered, they usually mean that farmers are struggling with the economics of modern agribusiness. But the movie thriller 40 Acres imagines a more physical danger. The film is set in a world of famine, violence, and lots of guns. You will hear the guns in critic Bob Mondello's review, but he says the film also provides food for thought.
The first images are of heavily armed intruders penetrating the perimeter of the Freeman family farm. Words on screen tell us that it's 14 years since a fungal pandemic wiped out 98% of the world's animals, 12 years since a war caused by food chain disruption. The world's population has plummeted due to famine, but this little plot of land in rural Canada, owned by a black family that moved here after the American Civil War, is an oasis of plenty, hence the intruders. A few approach the front of the house openly.
Greetings!
It's a nice little farm you got in this piece of land.
While others sneak around the barn into the cornfields and discover the Freeman family, mostly women and children, is ready. With knives and hatchets. And finally, gunfire. They were ready because Haley Freeman, played with steely resolve by Danielle Deadwyler, and her partner Galen, played by Michael Greyeyes, have brought them up to be. Haley's a former soldier, still in radio contact with others.
Freeman 1-2 Augusta 24, do you copy?
But the news is rarely good.
You've heard about the attack by now?
Thought your Union Army was gonna come and take care of it.
They're not. They're dead.
So Haley runs the farm as if she were its commanding officer, her kids' cadets.
Everybody carries a sidearm and a radio at all times, in the fields, when you sleep, everywhere.
Some of these people are posing as Union soldiers and workers, trying to get information. You can't trust what anyone says.
It is no accident that first-time feature filmmaker R.T. Thorne framed this story around a family that is Black and Indigenous. The older generation doesn't trust outsiders because they've learned from experience that they can't.
You see anybody, double back, do not engage. These folks will kill you for the boots on your feet.
But the youngsters, who've never known anything but the farm, are chafing at their isolation. 17-year-old Manny wonders if the sacrifice they make by being so cut off from the world is worth the safety it ensures.
We brought in some help. From where? The network? Other farms? I don't know.
Exactly. You don't know. You got no idea what these people are like out there.
Have you even tried talking to them?
Well, who the hell you think you're talking to? You got a roof over your head, food in your belly, while half the world's starving, and you got the nerve to complain about that?
But Manny, played by Kateyam O'Connor, has ventured outside the farm a few times to trade food for supplies, also to swim in the river. And one day, he sees a young woman there and starts to think maybe there's another way to live. The farm's generational divide is designed to hark back to civil rights and other social movements. Veterans deeply skeptical of engagement, a younger cohort convinced that isolation is ultimately limiting. Director Thorne has said in interviews he was putting a dystopian frame on current concerns like food insecurity, an age of Black Lives Matter, Indigenous land rights disputes. Though his film is often violent, he's had the good sense to use a gentler narrative framework to give 40 Acres its punch, a mother and a son with different ideas on how best to face the end of the world. I'm Bob Mandela.
What I've learned from a soldier, every man is a son to a daughter.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media. The Senate is next. Public media like KAXE brings you fact-checked news, connection to community, and great music. Free to everyone with no paywall. Public radio stations play a critical role in getting timely, accurate emergency information to the public, especially in rural and underserved areas. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Now's the time. Tell Congress, protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. Don't forget, your voice matters. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a soft grand opening and fundraiser for their new bike park Saturday, July 12th from noon to 5. Food and beverage will be available for purchase, plus you can play yard games and try the trails. Protective gear required if you are riding a bike. We receive support from AW Research Laboratories located in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. The Park Rapids Water Ski Team performs Saturday, July 12th at 6 p.m. at Halverson Beach in Nevis. Bring your own chair or beach towel. The McCroskey Art Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, hands-on activities, and live music. And the Bemidji Public Library has their summer book sale July 15th through the 17th from 10 to 6 each day at the Evangelical Free Church on Carr Lake Road. Thursday features a bake sale, cash or check only.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. The chef Roy Choi is a legend here in Los Angeles. So when I heard that he wanted to cook something with me, I was like, heck yeah.
And you go in and the kitchen feels like a food truck.
Oh, it's tight.
It's really tight. Butts be button in here.
Oh yeah, butts be button.
Butts be button.
Yeah.
Choi made a name for himself with his roving Kogi barbecue food trucks, which offer Korean short rib tacos, kimchi quesadillas. I mean, he put Korean Mexican fusion on the map here. And now he is out with his first ever full-on cookbook, The Choi of Cooking. And today, in his teeny tiny kitchen at the Alibi Room in West L.A., he is going to show me his ways.
You can't take your eye off this. You have to be fully engaged. Because the difference between delicious and burnt is minuscule.
We're frying up eggs, hash browns, tofu, and kimchi on the flat-top griddle here for Choi's take on the breakfast burrito. We throw down our massive tortillas, which he's going to show me how to roll right up.
Should I do max filling?
No.
Oh.
Not for your first time.
Okay.
That's advanced level.
All right.
Okay, now.
We pile on the hot stuff, top it with cheese, cilantro, onions, and a ginger sesame slaw.
And then now roll it.
Sides first. Uh-huh. Then this side.
Over, and then. No,
oh,
and then you're
going to
go over pinky, and over. Boom.
Really?
Amazing. Amazing.
Boom. Okay, but now the moment of truth. Could I, Elsa Chang, replicate the burrito mastery of the Kogi King himself? Well, there's only one way to find out. You know what they love on NPR? You know what sound they love the most?
ASMR?
Mouth sounds.
Okay, let's do that. Oh. Smell.
Mmm. This is good.
As you eat that, like, you don't think about the fact that it doesn't have meat.
No.
Right? You're just in there.
There's
so much flavor. So much flavor. It's like, it's rude. It's in your face. It's It's punk rock, but it's good for you.
I mean, this is a guy who rose to fame selling beef. The name of his food truck literally means meat in Korean. But now, Choi is on a quest to elevate the humble vegetable. It is the biggest chapter in his new cookbook. And this move towards a healthier, veggie-obsessed Roy Choi was a necessity for him, he says, a way to break what he calls an addiction to junk food and huge portions.
So a gallon of ice cream, I couldn't, you know, a pint was just like a hors d'oeuvre, like a devil. A pint was like a deviled egg, you know, like, you know, and so it had to be a half gallon or a gallon, you know, a corner slice of lasagna was like eating a crudité. So it had to be the whole tray.
Yeah.
If I ate less, people would ask me what's wrong.
Are you okay? Eventually, Choi met a customer at one of his taco trucks who got him to think differently about how he ate. And that nudged him down a new path towards cooking veggie-forward meals that are actually good for you. And that does not mean boring. The Choi of cooking, he says, is about making healthy eating exciting and approachable.
Because if you look at a lot of health food items and wellness, the wellness industry, things are packaged in a way that are very unfamiliar to someone that hasn't grown up around it or hasn't made a conscious choice to get there.
Did you set out wanting to make the vegetable chapter the biggest chapter?
I don't think in terms of structure we thought that way, but in terms of philosophy, yes.
Because you say, like, we don't treat vegetables with the respect they deserve.
You know, vegetables should curse. Like, they should be brash and curse, and they should, like, have their tongue out, you know, like a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
Like, you know? Like, it should look like the point of view of the double-double, you know? Like, that's how
a badass vegetable.
Badass, you know, badass food porn. In your face, like, it should be Spinal Tap 11, you know, and that's really what it should be. And that's why the vegetables were the biggest chapter, because that's the essence and philosophy of this book is, like, I want you to cook that dish in that chapter and forget that you're not cooking meat.
Yeah.
I want you to even think that you're cooking meat.
Right.
Because the recipes are designed as if there was meat in there, you know, and that's kind of the goal of it.
It's so true. We have so unfairly branded vegetables. Like, I think about the word broccoli. That's like synonymous for, like, give me the practical information. I like, just what's the broccoli and what you're actually saying? You know, like, you're vegetables.
But if you do it in slang, broccoli means cheese, it means cheddar, it means money. Yeah. You know, it means weed. You know,
yeah,
right. It means marijuana.
That's so.
So,
funny.
So if you take the slang of the essence of the feeling of it, and put a recipe and a perspective behind it, then maybe people can start eating vegetables.
Yeah.
Because they're smoking weed, and weed is a plant.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
People love plants.
People love plants.
All right. So show me, like, in this book, how you rebrand a couple of your favorite vegetables. Give me the Roy Choi rebrand.
Okay. Yeah, it definitely needs a rebrand. And so if you look at the Veg Head chapter, we'll just start from the top. You got watermelon kimchi, right? That's something that everybody loves a fruit cart.
Yeah.
Everybody loves a fruit cart they see a fruit cart.
Absolutely.
But they don't always love fruits when they're put on a plate, right? But then if you put watermelon into a kimchi form, then all of a sudden their minds are blown.
They're like,
I got to try it.
Yeah,
you gotta,
it's weird. It's unexpected. Let's do it.
You got to create some curiosity, you know. Crudités. This is the biggest one. Oh. Crudités is the hugest one in this book. Crudités have the worst branding.
I agree.
In the world.
That's the plate I skip when I'm at a buffet or I'm at a friend's house. I'm like, no, I'm going to go to the crackers and the cheese.
Yes.
Not the cut up vegetables.
Because what's crudité in most cases? It's usually the machine cut carrots that are kind of rounded on all ends.
Yeah, so they're dried out.
They're dried out. Celery and dried snow peas. And maybe
radishes.
Yeah. And then served with like Hidden Valley Ranch dressing. And then and then they're also associated with PTA meetings and mom and school meetings. Right. Because what is always brought to meetings is brownies, cookies, and crudité platters. So how do you make vegetables exciting, raw vegetables exciting? You go to the farmer's market and get really great vegetables, but that's not going to solve the problem. A crudité platter is not the crudités. It's the dips. It's the dips.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about the dips. And that's the problem with the marketing behind crudités, is that you're only serving it with ranch dressing or really bland hummus. You have to diversify your dips. And so
it's a dip platter, and the vegetables just the spoons for the dips.
Exactly. And you have to make them spicy, you have to make them garlicky, you have to make them funky, you have to do all of that stuff. So in this book, we have all of that.
Diversify your dips, people. The book is called The Choi of Cooking. It's out now, and it is the first full cookbook from the co-owner, co-founder, and chef of Kogi Barbecue, Roy Choi. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Total Wine and More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bangley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a presentation on emergency preparedness Tuesday, July 15th at 1 p.m. in collaboration with Senior Linkage Line. All are welcome.